Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift between now and the end of the year, we'll send you a CD of a Christmas and the Baptism of Jesus sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size year-end gift, we'll send you a CD of Todd's Christmas and Baptism of Jesus sermons.
A cadence that's more prayerful and more solemn and more really dignified. It's more complex, but that's good because it inspires the spiritual imagination to a much greater extent than the current translation.
It's like mixed up. They're mixed up. It's confusional rhyming. Confusion, confusion. All it's doing is causing confusion. You want to go to church and be confused?
It was a lot less difficult than I thought it might be. Even though probably all of us are going to end up, you know, holding our worship folders for a few weeks until we memorize all the new language.
There's various Roman Catholics responding after Sunday morning Mass to some of the changes to the Roman Catholic liturgy. It's a big deal, a really big deal, when you have 1 billion Christians across the world, and the Vatican, as of about 10 years ago, says, you know, we need to tweak the liturgy a little bit in its linguistic expression in all the ways that it's translated all over the world into all the hundreds and thousands of languages. It's a big, big deal. And you can't make that change on a whim when you're dealing with 1 billion Christians worldwide. Joining us to explain the why and the wherefore of the changes in the Roman Catholic liturgy, Dr. Paul Grimm. He's Dean of the Chapel and Associate Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Missions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, formerly served as Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Dr. Grimm, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
How does this differ, this change in the liturgy across Roman Catholicism, from the changes that were enacted after Vatican II?
Yeah, your question is loaded with all kinds of pre-questions I almost have to answer for you. just very briefly, Vatican II is a council in the early 60s in the Roman Catholic Church that enacted a number of reforms that really helped the Roman Catholic Church to catch up with the Protestants. 400 years before, during the Reformation, the Roman Catholic Church refused to make changes. One of those significant changes they didn't make at that time was to put the liturgy into the language of the people. They retained Latin. And that continued until the middle of the 20th century. At Vatican II, they made the pronouncement that, in fact, the liturgy should be in the language of the people. They didn't completely say there could be no Latin, but by and large, everyone interpreted it that way, put everything in the language of the people. And so the task began in the mid-60s of starting to do that. That was a big undertaking, and they didn't do it so well in some cases. And it's not surprising. Sometimes you have to take a couple stabs at it before you get it done well. When they did the first translations into English back in the late 60s, early 70s, they sort of followed the translation principles that were pretty in vogue at that time, and that was to aim for what we call a dynamic equivalence of translations. In other words, don't necessarily just translate word for word, but translate concepts and ideas, and even if you have to add new words and change things, I mean, as long as you're getting the idea across, that would be the goal. That was pretty much enforced for about 30 years or so, but it was in 2001 when the folks in Rome, at the headquarters at the Vatican, they issued a new set of instructions or interpretations for the Vatican Council's decrees regarding the liturgy. And one of those was to re-examine the translations and calling for a more faithful, formal, equivalent translation, you know, basically word for word whenever possible, so that one is as faithful to the original language as possible. And for the Roman Church, that's still Latin. I mean, they continue to issue all their liturgical services in Latin, and then it's the expectation that each of the different language groups in the world will go about making the translations into their language. So there's an English Language Commission of the Roman Catholic Church that includes representatives from the United States, Canada, Great Britain, South Africa, India, Australia, New Zealand, and even a few other places where English is spoken with some regularity in worship. And they work together to take the Latin originals that Rome issues and to make a faithful translation. And so that's sort of the overview, just to give a start to answer your question. The basic change was to move from a little looser translation to a more formal translation.
Well, people looking, especially American Protestants, looking in on this, might just think it's kind of quaint Because, of course, in American Protestantism, and even in our own circles, liturgical change is something that may happen every week, depending on the pastor's whims in the worst-case scenario. Why is Rome's policy here really a good policy for all Christians? That the form of worship not be changed without serious consideration and without a view toward how Christians in the past, that's what that Latin really is. It's just a record of how Christians in the past have worshiped.
Right. Well, that's a good question. And, I mean, for Rome, of course, this whole sense of, you know, the unity of the church is so significant for them, and the oneness of the church. All centered in the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, you know, and then through him, through the archbishops and bishops and cardinals. And the liturgy just becomes one expression of that unity that they hold. And so they have... It is amazing how the Roman Catholic Church, which has, you know, grown tremendously in all regions of the world, has found a way to, you know, to allow for a variety of diversity, a lot of cultural diversity, actually. And yet there's always this unity that exists around the one worship of the Church that she does, that she has promulgated from on high, in a sense. But as you say, is really, you know, a distillation and culmination of the whole, you know, the whole community of saints for generations and generations. You know, Rome certainly takes a long view, compared to many of our churches and many Protestant churches where it's week by week, everything changes. You know, Rome takes a very long view. When I was in my position with the Commission on Worship, I would meet each year with my counterparts in various churches, that included the Roman Catholic Church, and it was always fascinating to listen to their reports of how things were going. Because, you know, anything that they were going to prepare for an English translation, when it was prepared, it had to then be sent to Rome for approval. And what's amazing is how slow Rome could take, you know, her time to get the approval made. And, you know, he would report that, well, we submitted this 3 years ago, and we still don't know for sure if they received it or not. They haven't even acknowledged that they received it. Now, they had. They knew that. But that's how, you know, patient you had to be. You just had to wait for Rome, you know, to make up her mind. And you know, by comparison, you know, the expectations we have of constant change, just it's an amazing contrast. And is a good reminder, A, you know, if we think our church bureaucracy is bad, you know, think again. But B, I mean, there is wisdom in perhaps just taking our breath before we, you know, decide that we want to simply find some new expression, however the latest mood fits us, to try and proclaim the gospel with always the latest fad.
Well, when we come back, I want to return to that subject of unity. Having this common form of worship, is it more than just an expression of the unity? Does it actually also facilitate, create that unity insofar as it delivers the faithful word of God to us? Speaking of that unity, that life together, that's kind of the way that we've started to think about it, this life together, this unity that we have in Jesus Christ. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. It is the last day of November, and this is the last day it'll be our Book of the Month. Witness, Mercy, Life Together, all around that life that is in the Divine Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We cannot have the Trinity without having Witness, Mercy, Life Together. It's both a book and a DVD, the book from Dr. Albert Culver, and the DVD from none other than the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Pastor Matt Harrison, on the theme of Witness, Mercy, Life Together. Browse at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask for Witness, Mercy, Life Together, the book and the DVD, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Evangelical and Catholic. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do politicians see what our country really needs?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Although most of us are not yet thinking a lot about the next presidential election, potential contenders are working hard to determine what matters most to voters. Considering America's dangerously high debt and lagging job growth, many politicians focus on the economy at the expense of important social issues. But how free and just can we expect the economy to be in a society that doesn't recognize the value of every human life? The right to life is the right without which no other can exist. An important point to remember for politicians eyeing the next election.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about the changes in the Roman Catholic liturgy. Dr. Paul Grimm is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Paul Grimm is Dean of the Chapel and Associate Professor for Pastoral Ministry and Missions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he formerly served as Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Back to that subject of unity, Dr. Grimm, that common form of worship, and here we're talking in the Roman Catholic context as well as outside of it, isn't more than just an expression of that unity. Does it also facilitate that unity?
Oh, I think it does. Yeah, I mean, it is more than an expression because, you know, it is that very proclamation of the saving grace of God in Christ Jesus, which is what, you know, the Church's liturgy has handed down through the centuries has faithfully proclaimed. That liturgy has been encumbered with you know, sometimes with added stuff that gets in the way, and the Church has then had to look at reforming. I mean, that certainly is, you know, one can see that in the Reformation era. But yet there is just sort of this ongoing proclamation of the faith and that pointing to Christ, which just continues to sound forth no matter what, that really is of benefit to Christians. But you know, it's the challenge becomes when we perhaps aren't quite sure what the Church is, or what our place in the Church is. You know, that I've seen some people come into question that, and then for them, you know, this concept of one form of worship. And I'm not saying the form is going to be done the same everywhere, but it's still one set of texts. For Rome, it is the text that really is what is that unity. And the strength that brings is something that we too often take for granted.
How would you characterize the changes that are made here in terms of content? The one that's making the news and the headlines is the salutation, the Lord be with you. And Catholics have been taught since Vatican II in English to say, and with you, and also with you. And now it's going to return to the older form, and with your spirit. Talk about those changes.
Yeah. Well, you know, when these translations were first done into English for the first time in the late 60s, I mean, that was a time of great social change in our country, and even with language, too. I'm not sure how I want to characterize the translations then. They were almost a little folksy at times, as also the music was. The first liturgical music they prepared for people to actually to sing, kind of this folksy quality to it. And we even experienced that in our own circles. When our worship supplement was published in 1969, there was one service in there that basically began, "Here we are, God." It was like a surprise. It wasn't quite that bad in the first Roman translations, but it was just a looser form. I mean, that was a time, interestingly, when there was an interest in unity within terms of use of text, even among Protestants. And it was at that time that the International Consultation on English Texts was formed. It was sort of a an ecumenical group that was charged with trying to come up with common text. And They did. And they published those texts in 1970. So it was about the same time the Roman Rite. And so there was clearly a cross-pollination of ideas going back and forth with their translations and with these common agreed-upon translations. And those translations, those common texts that were published back in the early 70s, I mean, we use those because settings 1 and 2 in Lutheran Service Book are those texts. And a lot of people may not realize that. But what happened, interestingly, various things took place. I mean, within Rome, there certainly have been changes since the 1960s. Pope John Paul II, I mean, sort of made this grand turn in the Roman Church to a more conservative bent. And certainly, you know, the move in this regard with the translation of the Mass was a part of that. In 1998, this English Language Commission of the Roman Church, they had proposed a new set of translations of the Roman Mass and had sent it to Rome for approval. And Rome didn't give approval because they had even just become freer with the translations. And just, again, this dynamic equivalence approach of not wanting to be bound word for word with translations but to aim for the concepts and ideas. It happened that Rome was already in the process of issuing a new edition of the Roman Mass in Latin, sort of the official version. And so they said, we don't even try to repair this, just wait. Wait till the new version comes out. And then in 2001 was when the bomb was dropped, the big explosion occurs, when Rome issues this new set of instructions on translating. It came out in March of 2001, and it really caught the Roman Catholic world by storm, by surprise, I should say. And I remember being in a conference with a couple Roman Catholic pastors just a few months after that, and they were just taken aback how horrible this is going to be because it's going to change the way people have been worshiping for 30 years. You know, oh my goodness. When they went to English, it changed how they've been worshiping for millennia. But there was a lot of consternation and concern. But just again, to see how slowly Rome works, that was 2001. It's now 2011 when they finally have implemented the changes. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. They were very methodical about it, very careful. And in fact, even the final introduction of it has been very careful. This new translation was approved a year and a half ago, but they still gave it a whole year and a half before they implemented the changes, knowing that people needed to be prepared. And it sounds like they've done a fairly careful job of trying to help prepare people and even using this as a teaching moment to help them to understand a little bit better the changes in translation that have taken place. To answer your question more specifically, the salutation, the Lord be with you and with thy spirit or with your spirit, that is certainly one of the translation changes that probably will catch people, at first by surprise the most, simply because that response that we've been using for so long and also with you is just so well known. I mean, I've argued that's probably the best known liturgical response in Christendom, even among people who don't use the liturgy in many churches. They don't use the liturgy, but they still know that response. But again, it is going back to the a literal translation of the Latin text, which was their goal. Other changes, the creed is one. Back in the 1970s, again, when these translations of the liturgical text were agreed upon, the Nicene Creed, a change was made at that point in the translation, and most Protestants went with that change also. And that was to use the first person plural to begin the creed. We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, rather than I believe. That does go back to the original issuing of that creed in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. But when the creed had entered the liturgy many centuries later, it entered it in using the first person singular, I believe. And Rome says, that's how it ought to be confessed, not with the we believe, as churches have been doing in recent decades, but what the church has confessed for over a millennium in her liturgy with the singular form, I believe in one God. So there are changes like that that are sort of at the forefront, but there's also lots of massaging of text in little places here and there that will catch people, it'll cause their ears to perk up as they hear things a little differently in the coming years.
With regard to that, the creedal change, because that seems to be of a different caliber than even something as common as the salutation, and I understand the history there with respect to the Nicene Creed itself. I guess it causes the natural question, which is, we have, with the exception of singing Luther's version, Creedal's hymn, We All Believe in One True God, we've become accustomed to that first person singular. What do you think? Would we do well to kind of follow in the footsteps, the wisdom of the of the Roman Church here and the Western tradition and say maybe we should go back and say this the way it was originally issued by the Council of Nicaea?
Yeah. You know, I think in that regard, I mean, one can argue both ways. And when we prepared the Lutheran Service Book, I mean, we struggled with this issue, you know, considerably. And at first, I mean, the first proposal from the commission was actually to go back to the plural form, we believe in one true God. And if I remember correctly, it was actually the floor committee of the convention of the synod in 2004 that decided maybe we should just stay with the translation we've been used to, out of concern for the change and how that will affect folks. I mean, I think one can make the argument a variety of ways. When we made the proposal to go to the plural, we believe, I mean, we had some pushback from some people who said, you know, you can only believe for yourself. That's what the catechism says, and referring to the explanation that the synod has published of Luther's catechism. But yeah, I mean, you're quite right that the initial issuing of that creed in 325 was, you know, a common confession of the whole church as she was gathered together there in Nicaea, and in fact, when we are gathered together, one could fittingly understand our confession to be of a common faith that we all hold. That it's not any individual's personal confession, but it is the church's confession. I don't think there's a satisfactory answer to the question, very honestly, And these are tough decisions churches have to make along the way. And right now in the Roman Catholic Church, this is the direction they've decided to go, to stay with that first person singular, which they had done for so many years, but have in recent years have not, and likewise with some of the other changes.
When we come back, care is being exercised, obviously, by the Roman Catholic Church in doing this with the utmost care, even the slightest changes with the greatest of care. We'll talk about how we do this, even the slightest change, in the people's worship, in the church, with the greatest of care. Dr. Paul Grimm is our guest. He's Dean of the Chapel and Associate Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Missions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, formerly served as Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Folks, please help support Issues Etc., Sacramental Historical Liturgical Talk Radio, by making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Now, with just about a month to go in the year, we're currently about $67,000 short of making our budget this year. You can make a year-end tax-deductible contribution by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. Send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. That's LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a year-end donation online at issuesetc.org. For any size year-end donation, we're going to send you a CD of two sermons, one on Christmas and the other on the baptism of Jesus that I preached. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of this year. When we come back, how do we do this with the utmost care, making liturgical changes? Stay tuned. Hey, St. Louis listeners, our local affiliate, AM 1320, Bot Radio Network, lowers its signal power at 445 until the end of the year, but you can still listen to Issues Etc. full power at issuesetc.org. Old theology, new technology, issuesetc.org. Listen to what you want, when you want. Issues Etc.
Unto You, a Christmas sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
The angel can tell those shepherds and tell us, this child has been born unto you. This child has been born for you.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon for any size gift before the end of the year. Make a secure online donation today, issuesetc.org. Thanks for thinking of us at the end of 2011.
Sacramental, historical, liturgical. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
How is it that many of the champions of the Great Commission actually deny what the Great Commission says? I've written part two of the Not-So-Great Commission for the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just send an email to journal@issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Ellie Caro writes about the uncertainty of personal moral improvement and the certainty of the external promises of God. The online Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. 10 more minutes in our conversation with Dr. Paul Grimm, talking about changes in the Roman Catholic liturgy. They now actually appear to be kind of changes that are a general trend in the liturgy life of the church. But these things are embedded in the memory and the lives and the piety of the Christians who practice them, Dr. Grimm. How do we do this? Even the slightest change in the church's liturgy with the greatest of care.
Right. Yeah, that is the challenge. How does one do it carefully? And it was heartening to see, you know, in some of the literature that the Roman Catholic Church realized that they had to do it carefully. Because it can be very easy when you are in a top-down structure, as they are, to simply say, this is what it will be, now, you know, get over it. But, just to use our own context with Lutheran Service Book and the work we did in preparing that, you know, we face that question constantly, and it sometimes it can haunt you. You know, Luther, in the preface to his catechism, makes the point, you know, choose a translation and stick with it. Don't change it. You know, and some people would throw that in our face as we were preparing the hymnal, say, don't change anything. I think even Luther would probably acknowledge that, you know, his plea to keep the same form so people can learn it and it does become embedded in their heart, that maybe it can't always be followed. And in fact, Luther's translation of the Bible, his own evidence, I mean, his own practice shows that up until he died, he was continually tinkering with his translation, trying to find just the right word, you know, and phrase and to get the translation as perfect as possible. Now, I mean, one could argue that's the first time it'd been put into German. It's going to take some time to get it right, and so, you know, you give them that leeway of understanding that. And yet, it's the same issue of you know, when does one make a change, when does one not? And I think, I mean, it calls for great care on the part of those who are charged with making, you know, preparations of service materials. But it also calls, I think, ultimately then, you know, assuming that they have done their work carefully and have not just made, you know, willy-nilly changes anywhere, it calls for the people to look at the work that's been prepared and to receive it with a degree of charity and realizing that, you know, yeah, they've tried their best, but they have made some changes here they think are better. You know, if I can understand why those changes have been made, I can accept that and I'll live with it and move on. It sort of has to go on all sides, I think, to some degree. As everything does in the church, if we're going to live together as one body.
Would you talk about, because I think many people have a misconception of Reformation history with regard to the liturgy. They would assume, sometimes even Lutherans assume this against better knowledge, that when Luther undertook liturgical reform, if you will, and the other reformers did as well, they simply started with the blank slate. They just kind of wiped the slate clean and said, okay, how should Christians worship? How did they actually undertake the task of liturgical reform at the time of the Reformation?
Yeah, well, Luther, for sure, did not do that. He approached it very conservatively. He recognized the witness that was had been handed down, in a sense, that grand heritage of how the church had worshipped over the centuries. And he was not about to throw it all out. In his writings, and he doesn't have a lot of writings, really, on the liturgy. It's fairly limited, just within a few years span, in fact. But he makes it clear that, you know, there will be some theological concerns and principles that will simply, you know be the order of the day, and the chief thing being, you know, anything that robs Christ of his merit will have to go. And so he uses the phrase, you know, anything that smacks of the mass, a sacrifice. In such a sense that we are offering a sacrifice to God that propitiates for sin, you know, that has to go. But beyond that, he really is very careful and preserves the church's liturgy fairly intact, especially in his first revision in 1523, which was his Latin Mass. He kept it in Latin for the most part. Readings and sermon will be in German, but much of the service remains in Latin. He makes changes, more changes when he does his German Mass 3 years later, but even still one has this sense that, you know, the church's heritage is not going to be thrown out by any means. And in fact, then, you know, Lutheran churches around Germany and the Scandinavian countries very much, you know, they sort of take the middle road in many cases between the two different approaches Luther had taken, but again, it's continually showing a preservation of that heritage, recognizing that, you know, in one sense, the liturgy and the use of the liturgy binds us with the church of all ages, with all those who have come before us who have worshipped in a similar manner. I mean, it's not exactly the same by any means. I mean, we don't worship the way Luther worshipped. If we were plunked down in the middle of the 16th century into a church service, we'd feel like, you know, fish out of water. But one could still get a very clear sense of you know, the organization of the service and even what's being done, even if you don't understand the language. But, you know, of course, some have argued, even within Lutheranism, since Luther, that he didn't go far enough. And that's been one of the challenges the Lutheran Church has wrestled with throughout the centuries, right into our present age. Some would say that Luther didn't go far enough in his reforms and should have, in fact, started from scratch, thrown it all out, as a few of the other reformers did do. I mean, they really did eliminate much of the tradition and sort of just developed this blank slate and developed this service of some readings and preaching and praying and singing, but it didn't have this large, you know, strong structure of word and sacrament that had been handed down for centuries.
Two quick final questions. What should we hope to learn from the fact that the Roman Catholic Church, who indeed does take this long and considered view of even the smallest change, what should we hope to learn from their latest changes in their Mass?
Mm-hmm. Well, we knew of, you know, as we prepared Lutheran Service Book, we knew of this coming change that they had have now finalized, because those instructions have been issued right in the middle of our work, and in some ways confirmed some of the direction which we were going, because it was our intention from the start to try and provide a, you know, to make our translations, when they needed adjusting, to make them as carefully done as possible and as close to the original as possible. So, for example, and this is the one I can just think of right now, in the Creed, there's another phrase that caused a lot of consternation and conversation in the Synod, and that was over the phrase, "Who for us men and for our salvation came down from heaven." Most modern translations have left out the word "men," simply saying, "Who for us and for our salvation." And, you know, what that has done, it's clear what it says, but it's just left out a word from the original, and it's not translating it. And as soon as you do that, that can start to raise questions. I mean, we received lots of feedback when we made a proposal that we might translate that differently. But throughout the process, we decided we weren't going to just drop the word, which is also how the latest revisions in the Roman Catholic Church have gone. They have returned back to "Who for us, men, and for our salvation," just as we have confessed it for many years. So I mean, I think that in some ways it confirmed the direction we were going to some degree. Well, what we discovered in our work was trying to be consistent in following these principles is very difficult, because different situations raise up different issues and challenges. When we were working on the hymns for the hymnal, I mean, every hymn almost had to be looked at, you know, on its own merits, and you tried to apply similar principles, but you couldn't always do that. And the liturgy, I think, is the same case. But I think it did confirm that we were moving in the right direction ourselves in trying to make sure that our translations were as careful as they could be. And that even included the choice of Bible translation for the hymnal project as well.
Finally, then, with about a minute, make the case why churches should use the historic liturgy.
I have to teach my whole class to you here. I think several things. It binds us with those who have gone before us. I mean, that faithful cloud of witnesses from centuries. And as I said, we haven't worshipped just like they worshipped, and yet it is amazing how similar the church's worship has been for century upon century. Given the rapid, massive change we experience daily in our lives, and with the technology just pushing us to the limits, there is something about the church saying, "Hold on, you know, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever," And the church's worship, in a sense, reflects that. We still, you know, we use new technology even in worship, new instruments, new instrumentation. We use new musical settings. I mean, it doesn't stay just the same. And yet there is something about that worship which all points to Christ. And that ultimately, I say, would be the final point, is that there really has been nothing proven better to deliver Christ than the church's historic worship that we've received from our forefathers.
Dr. Paul Grimm is Dean of the Chapel and Associate Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Missions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He formerly served as Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Paul, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to be talking with Adrian Dorr of the Lutheran Witness magazine. And we'll respond to your phone calls on the subject of what women wear to church. Adrian has recently written about it, and she says women need to kind of own up to the fact that they're not dressing appropriately, regardless of their age. A little bit of Open Lines follows that conversation with Adrian Dorr tomorrow on Issues Etc. Friday on the program, we'll talk with Pastor Heath Curtis about 8th century hymn writer, defender of icons. He's called the last of the fathers, John of Damascus. That's Friday on Issues Etc. I think that we should learn our lesson, and that is the church does not need to allow the wind of culture to dictate how Christians gather around the word and sacraments and what form that worship takes. I don't think the culture should have a vote on Sunday morning. I think the word of God and the church, the wisdom of that church throughout the ages, should be the only vote that counts there. Look at 1 billion Catholics worldwide. It's hard to argue with it. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.